Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I need a better catchphrase. Please send me your suggestions for an opening line, because I'm going to have to say it a lot of times, and that's not a very good one. Today we are discussing Chapter 4 and then reading Chapter 5. The discussion prompts that I provided for the community, are: have you ever felt like fate, the old ninny woman, has brought you somewhere merely to have your nose dragged away as you were about to nibble the sacred cheese of life? I know I have. Number 2, just what the heck were those fools doing on the beach? And number 3, do you think they made the right decision heading back out to open water? And a bonus question was, what was your favourite line of this chapter? Spa Girl Jen said, I don't think I've ever felt that way about fate, but I did love this line. I think maybe the people on the beach need to themselves be rescued and were trying to signal the boat, thinking it was coming for them. Interesting. I didn't consider that those people were in trouble. I think I was thinking the same thing as the crew on the dinghy, that they were just idiots who couldn't figure out that the people on the boat were in trouble. Like some kind of, you know, happy, foolish holiday makers. But why then did they wave that jacket? Like that guy just waving his, was it his jacket? Yeah, I think he was waving his jacket around his head on the shore. He just waved it and waved it and waved it until he faded into the darkness of night, still waving it. Which is such a funny image, but you'd just be watching him go and do something productive. Why are you standing there waving your jacket? Spa Girl Jen also said, going back out to sea was maybe their only choice at this point, as it seems a little calmer than trying to reach the shore. Yeah, I think so too. I think they did make the right call. But if they had gone to try to reach the shore, it would have been a dice roll for sure. But there would have been a chance that they could have made it. Right? So, I don't know. I kind of wish they took that chance. Part of me does, at least. Because I'm worried about their fate now that they're stuck out overnight on this dinghy. Spa Girl Jen also said the question at the end about pie was great. Like, what else is there to do in that situation but think about something else? Coconut creme pie would be my answer. My answer would be a sort of an Aussie meat pie with tomato sauce. Man, that made me hungry just saying that. I think that was my favourite line of this chapter too. The final line. Billy, he murmured dreamfully, what kind of pie do you like best? And it was the cook who said that, but for me, it was almost like, it was like a sort of dreadful line, because it's like he's so close to giving up, he's so close to failing, that it's like a last-ditch effort to take his mind off his problems and bring up a conversation about pie. It's almost like he's teetering on becoming a bit sort of delirious or desperate. Don't taunt, Pepito said. I came around to the point of view that they were signaling them to travel to the north to the House of Rescue. That is a cool idea, though, that they were stranded on the island as well. Why did you think the people on the shore were in need of rescue? Spa Girl Jen responded, like that waving of the shirt was like them trying to signal for help. Like maybe it's an island or something that they can't get off for whatever reason. Now thinking about it more, probably not likely since they had a car there, and given how old this book is. Maybe it's my exposure to modern horror movie tropes getting to me, or too many years of Gilligan's Island. Rugged Toaster said, did anyone else feel that the pie statement was a bad omen? Yes, absolutely I did. Dreaming about things like food in books, shows and movies, where life is threatened, some seems to be a trope which usually comes with bad news. Yeah. I don't know. For me, it was like, I know he's trying to take their minds off it and raise a sort of light conversation, but there was this sort of desperate last ditch attempt feeling about it for me, which really, it was almost like a scary line, like the author might as well have said that, you know, a shark had popped its head out of the water, because it was like something from a horror movie, a little bit, that line. I don't know why it struck me that way. Might just be, it's probably completely a subjective opinion on it. It might not have had that effect on everybody, but for me it was just like a sinking feeling in my stomach, almost. Amvuk said, "This isn't in response to a particular discussion prompt, but it's more an observation about the chapter." By the way, that's totally fine. I encourage that. The prompts are really there to just start a conversation, because my greatest fear is that, well, you know, if there's no conversation about the chapter, then this whole thing kind of falls over. That's the whole point. But I know it can be hard to think of what to discuss. So the prompts are really just there to prompt you to articulate your thoughts on the chapter. But if you do not need the prompts in order to have an opinion on the chapter, or to speak your mind about it, or to raise questions about it, or to lend insights to the chapter, by all means, go off on your own tangent, write your own questions, your own comments. You don't have to address the prompts. Okay, that's about as clear as I can make it. Sorry if that sounds like I'm stressing that a little bit too much. But I don't know, I suppose it's important. Amvuk said, "In this chapter, there is a lot of back and forth regarding optimism, hope, and whether death is imminent. In the same vein, many lines repeat and call back to each other. This happens especially when the men are trying to figure out whether the people on the beach see them, and if the omnibus is a boat. This almost seems to me to have the cadence of waves and the uncertainty of the surf. I really enjoyed this chapter, although I am still confused about the people on the beach. I am rooting for these guys." Guaranardel, I really don't know how to pronounce this particular username. I'm going to be butchering this for a long time to come. Guaranardel said, "I agree about the cadence of waves. You get the sense that their hours are spent doing the same thing over and over, but they are hopeful that it will be what saves them. I especially liked the description of the rowing shifts, and the oiler rowed, and then the correspondent rowed, then the oiler rowed. It was a weary business." It kind of started to feel like the prose took on the rhythm and, as Amvuk said, the cadence of the waves lapping at the boat, which was really, really well done. You know, when you're in a situation where there is a rhythm, a background sort of unavoidable rhythm to it, and then after a while you sort of start, like your thoughts start to tick over with the same rhythm of your surroundings. Like if you're in, say, a room with a large motor or something, like the motor engine room of something, and it's kind of vibrating and loud, and it's kind of like the whole room, it kind of pulsates with the rhythm. Eventually, if you've got no escape from that noise and that atmosphere, you sort of start to sync up with it a little bit. And I imagine the movement of the boat rocking up and down on the waves, and the sound of the ocean and the rhythm of the water would eventually start to sort of resonate inside their minds. The prose itself was almost as if it was resonating with that rhythm, which I just think is so cool. Arvip said, "I found it interesting. They were angry at the old woman Fate for her incompetency and the resulting cruelty of their circumstances, rather than considering Fate was perhaps punishing them for something. Many who question Fate might consider, 'Why me? What have I done?' But instead they feel Fate is simply unfit to manage the affairs of men." My favourite line relates to the above. If this old ninny woman fate cannot do better than this, she should be deprived of the management of men's fortunes. Honourable mention, Billy, he murmured dreamfully, what kind of pie do you like best? Yeah, Arvib, actually that line is really good too. It's really relatable. I've, you know, not quite so eloquently, but I've definitely felt or thought the same thing before. That kind of feeling like if there is a God, they're doing a terrible job of, attributing fairness to this situation. A raspberry jam said, what kind of pie do you like best? Now that sure brightens the mood. Did it brighten the mood? It was almost like a bit of a pathetic attempt to brighten the mood. Pathetic maybe is not the word. Pitiful attempt to brighten the mood. I didn't like it. I mean, I loved that line. I thought that was really well written. But I mean, yeah, it gave me a bad feeling. Regarding the question, just what the heck were those fools doing on the beach? A raspberry jam said they seemed to indicate that they couldn't accommodate any more personnel while being happy that they weren't in such a treacherous situation. You think that's what they were doing? Like, essentially, sucks to be you kind of thing. But then what was with that long waving of the jacket around the guy's head? I don't understand what he was doing. And regarding the question, do you think they made the right decision heading back out to open water? A raspberry jam said, had they made a rush for the shore, all of them might not have made it. Yeah, it was a roll of the dice. I mean, either way is a roll of the dice. It's a risk either way, but which one has a lower risk? Probably the heading out, back out to the water, is a lower risk option. It requires more patience. It's a more frustrating option, but it's probably the lower risk. But then it didn't pan out how they would have hoped. So they've actually ended up in quite a dangerous situation, having to spend another night in the boat. The man waving a coat blended gradually into this gloom, and it swallowed in the same manner the omnibus and the group of people. That was a raspberry jam's favourite line. Yeah, that was another good one. It was very visual. You could watch that man waving his coat blending gradually into the darkness of the night. Mr. Philip Pirrip said, the repetition of phrases is something that really stands out to me. Mentioning the men rowing over and over again, the repeated snippets of dialogue, mirroring the crashing of the waves that continually bombarded the boat. As someone mentioned in a previous post, I enjoy Crane's inclination to wink at the reader. It is fair to say here, there was not a life-saving station within 20 miles. One thing I've also noticed is that whenever the narrator is involved in the story or breaks the fourth wall, there is always more humour inserted into the narrative, such as they surpassed records in the invention of epithets. Yet, whenever the actual events in the boat are being more objectively described, especially towards the end of the chapter, the mood is far more sombre. This story truly reads like a man recalling a harrowing adventure at sea, but jovial or happy he has survived it, laughing at the tragedy so narrowly avoided, triumphant. If I'm not mistaken, this is in fact based on a true story from Crane's life on his way to Cuba, right? I can easily see this story being the story told at a bar to a captive audience. Silver Lining said, yes, interestingly, the narrator momentarily spoke in first person, trying to recall a small detail in the previous chapter. That is interesting, and it kind of slipped under my radar because I kind of didn't notice these changes in narrative perspective, which is a testament to the skill of the author, because usually any kind of switch in narrative perspective stands out like a sore thumb. So it is very well done. And I am starting to get that feeling, Mr. Philip Pirrip, that you're describing about it almost being like him recalling the story to a captive audience. Waraka Akbar said, The sacred cheese of life is such a strange expression. I don't know if it was a common phrase in the 1800s or if it's a reference to something else. Did we know the oiler's name was Billy? Is that the first non-title name we've learned? Yes, I think we did. We did know his name was Billy. That was right in the first chapter. The captain refers to the oiler as Billy. But do we know any other names? I think we might only know Billy. And Waraka Akbar says that their favourite pie is pecan pie. Never tried a pecan pie. I think that's a very American thing, and I'm sure you can get it in Australia, but I just don't think I've ever had it. Is that like a sweet pie? It's like a desserty kind of one. See, in Australia, when I think pie, like if you say I had a pie in Australia, it's like predominantly you think savory, like a meat pie, a pie with like meat in it with some sauce. It's like something you have for lunch. Unless you specify like an apple pie or something like that. Anyway, that's a weird sidetrack. Pie speak. Let's get down to some serious pie talk, people. We've got to sort this thing out. I'm also curious, Americans and, other people from across the pond, have you ever had a meat pie? Like an Aussie meat pie? It's got like meat, beef usually, and like a bit of this sort of sauce, gravy sauce in it, and then you put tomato sauce or ketchup on top. Is that a thing in America? A few months in Tokyo. 6 or 7 months I was in Tokyo. And the thing that was like the most troubling for me was that I couldn't find a meat pie anywhere. They just didn't exist. I thought that was so weird. I think in the UK you've got meat pies, don't you? And you put peas on them or something weird like that. Anyway, let's move past this whole meat pie thing. B. Falgren said, I think they named him in the first chapter. Yeah, they did. Keep her a little more south, Billy, said he. A little more south, sir, said the oiler in the stern. Thanks, Befalgreen, for looking that up. Befalgreen said, I also looked through and didn't see any other names in chapters 1 through 4. I wonder why Billy is called out but not the others. That is a bit strange. Username, long string of numbers, googled the phrase about the sacred cheese of life and said that the only results were from Crane's story. Since the phrase doesn't seem to be used anywhere but in Crane's story, as far as I can tell from the quick search I did, it seems like his own invention with a specific meaning behind it. Techrific said, B.C. Shu mentioned the Odyssey in the last chapter, and that was very apt, because using an epithet like the old ninny woman for fate seemed to me like an echo of the old Greek epic, where the important characters are given epithets, and fate is certainly looming large over the scene here. I feel their statement of fate as a ninny is a clear case of the old Greek hubris, so now I fear even more for the fellas. The fools on the beach seemed as incomprehensible to us, the readers, as the fate-marked crew in the boat. Have they escaped from some gothic lunatic asylum and now aimlessly roam the shoreline? I don't know, but perspectives are important and we're fully engaged in and on the side of the boat crew. Had the point of view shifted to those on the shore, we would understand their behaviour. As Evelyn Waugh said in Brighthead Revisited, to understand all is to forgive all, but we don't understand, so we don't forgive. Yeah, those guys on the beach, what were they doing? I love that we don't know, and I love that it's as confusing for us, the readers, as it is for the people on the boat. That whole chapter really was like frustrations mounting, right? Mounting impatience, mounting frustrations, and this detail of being spotted by people on land. And you think at that point, that's it. We've done it. We're saved. But then these stupid people on land just stand there looking and waving their jacket and not being helpful in the slightest. It's so frustrating. Confusing and frustrating. And so to omit those details of what those people were doing, yeah, that's really clever writing. Swim said the Mama Fishy, awesome username, said several favourite lines for me. Funny they don't see us. Especially since this line was repeated several times. Four scowling men sat in the dinghy and surpassed records in the invention of epithets. Epithets, by the way, I had to search what these are, an adjective or descriptive phrase expressing a quality, characteristic of the person or thing mentioned. So it's when you name the thing after its defining characteristic, right? Something like that. The ass, he's an idiot. I'd like to catch the chump who waved the coat. I feel like socking him one just for luck. He seemed so damn cheerful. I like the juxtaposition of the direness, of the situation. They very well could die out there. The fact that they are so close but yet so far, and the comedic dialogue. The tension is balanced really nicely. Befalgren said, everyone feels like fate is against them sometimes. Kind of like unrequited love or an opportunity that doesn't pan out. Regarding what the fools were doing on the beach, Befalgren said, probably people out on a day trip who didn't realise our characters in the boat were in peril. It's a conflict of perspectives. One thinking it's all fun and games and the other in danger. Righty McRightface, another awesome username, said, I think the guy waving the coat on the shore was trying to signal something, considering how long he was waving it for. He started in the afternoon and continued until sunset. That would be a lot of effort just to wave at or mock someone. I hope we find out later just what the heck those fools were doing. Yeah, as do I. Can you imagine if we just don't? That'll be pretty frustrating. But actually, I've kind of got a feeling that that's what's going to happen. And does Befalgren think they made the right decision heading back out to open water? Probably, although I anticipate the thought of what could have been safety on shore will haunt them for the next chapter at least. Yeah, right. Now they're going to second guess whether or not they should have just gone for it. The Tinosaurus said, I agree with a number of others. I don't feel like the tour group had any idea the men weren't out there by choice. Also, I feel like the captain's condition is getting worse. Head resting on the boat, drooped over the water barrel with no interest in actually drinking any, to question Billy about pie. Sajaza said, I loved all the dialogue in this chapter, especially when they're trying to figure out what the beach fools were up to. Not only did it bring a greater sense of confusion and desperation to the men's plight, but I also found it humanized the characters a bit more. What do you think of those life-saving people? Ain't they peaches? I'm not sure who said this, but it tells me they are sarcastic even in the direst of circumstances. Funny they haven't seen us. Whereas whoever's repeating this line over and over appears to be in denial. It also seems increasingly likely that Billy might end up being the leader, which might also mean something bad will happen to the captain. Billy's the one that decides to go back out into the ocean after asking the captain if it's all right. The cook and the correspondent ask Billy random questions. Did you ever like to row? And what kind of pie do you like best? As a means of passing the time. He's also the only named character, so I'm guessing that's a deliberate choice to emphasize his importance. My favorite line was probably, four scowling men sat in the dinghy and surpassed records in the invention of epithets. Adrians95 said, this is the first time I've been caught up on the podcast in months, so I'm excited to be able to participate. Hey, welcome back, Adrians95. You must have come from the A Year of War and Peace challenge. So, welcome to phase two of this podcast. I'm not sure what the people on the beach are doing, but I'm sympathetic to the idea that they don't realise the men in the boat are in danger. The irony there, combined with the twist of Crane getting our hopes up as they approach the shore, only to have to turn back to see would be really fitting. Hello Newman, great username, said, I think the people on the beach represent those who tempt fate to change course. There are many moments in life you are expected to follow your course and see through whatever path you have charted. The flailing and commotion on the beach is representative to one of those moments where you almost decide to stray from it. Yes, he chose correctly by going back to sea. You know what I kept thinking is, if you could see each other waving a shirt or a jacket or whatever it was, or a bath towel in the case of the people on the boat, why aren't they yelling out to each other? Why aren't they screaming out to each other? Right? Doesn't that seem like and they might only just be able to hear it, but they'd be able to at least hear that they're calling out. Anyway, the Marigold Fields said, I really liked the roller coaster of emotions in this chapter, with the men starting out furious when they realize they won't be rescued, then ecstatic when they spot the people on the beach, then angry again when they realize they really won't be rescued. I can't help but feel like the sailors made a bad choice by choosing to go back out to sea instead of heading toward land. There were a few lines in the last chapter that pointed out the group had gone about a day without food and with little rest, and this chapter had some lines in it that point out the men's exhaustion, namely the paragraph suggesting the men, when resting, would easily let themselves be taken by the sea should the boat capsize. I feel like if they'd fought to make land just a little harder, their ordeal would be over. Yeah, that's the thing about this chapter, isn't it? It's like, it leaves you with that second-guessing feeling, wondering what could have been. As Origa said, I'm a bit surprised this isn't a more popular line, but it struck me as both incredibly beautiful and tragic. If I am going to be drowned, why in the name of seven mad gods who rule the sea was I allowed to come thus far and contemplate sand and trees? Yeah, that was a cool line, wasn't it? Very nice line. While never so dramatically and theatrically, it was a line that resonated with me and I could relate to. It was made all the more impactful that it was uttered in the same chapter as so many more light-hearted statements, like their record-breaking list of epithets, calling fate a ninny, and of course the ever-important question of pie preference. Because it makes them human in their desire to maintain hope, but it reminds us, almost cruelly, how harsh that ninny fate can be, and just how desperate one's plight can be, with no rhyme or reason. I also found it interesting that there were multiple occasions where the characters repeat lines as their desperation grows. This was a fantastic way to show their desperation and the pleading nature of their unheard cries for help. Yeah, very cool. It does lend it to feel like they're starting to plead or beg or even pray. I'm not sure if it more evokes the feeling of begging or pleading for intervention, or evokes the feeling of shock or someone struggling to grasp the dire reality of the situation, turning the thought over in your head, trying to find a better view you can accept. Very cool. Very cool observations there, as Origa. Laura Y. Stitch said, I liked when the writing went into the first person, but it never specifies who is having the thoughts. It's like all of them are having the same thoughts. Final line of the chapter was my favourite. Amusing and almost also a cliffhanger, because what kind of pie does he like best? I'm not sure if they made a good decision to head back into open water or not, but it shows that they still have optimism at this point, that the conditions will improve or a better opportunity will present themselves than swimming in rough waters. It is a cliffhanger. I kind of didn't even consider that. I do hope we now find out the preference of pie flavors among the shipmates. silver linings that I'm not actually reading along, I'm just listening along, and I'm loving it. Each chapter sounds like its own short story, really holding my attention and firing my imagination. I like the psychological progressions. First chapter, flight or fight. Second chapter, where there is life, there is hope. The third chapter, denial of their peril with unrealistically happy puffs on their cigars. And this chapter, anger, frustration, and a little blame. What's next, do you think? Cool question. What are the psychological progressions in crisis? All right. Fight and flight, hope, denial, anger. My gut instinct is to say what's the word for giving up? Like resignation, loathing, self-loathing, resignation. Apathy, maybe. Maybe they're going to become sort of bitter and angry. Well, more angry. Turn on each other. Eesh, I could see it going really downhill from here, actually. I suppose it kind of depends what happens to them next. All right. They're going to be hyper-vigilant looking for a win of some kind. Something to go their way, because nothing's gone their way for quite a while now. And so that little win, the tide turning in their favor, might keep the morale up. Otherwise, it could plummet. Also, good leadership at this point could keep the morale up. But that's sort of yet to be seen what will happen there. Wasm said, "The comedy, the repetition, the cursing of fate all seem to help to try and deny the situation. Especially having the land right there, just too far out to reach or to effectively communicate with people on the coast. That must be a horrible feeling." All right, I think it's time we move on and read Chapter 5. This is Stephen Crane's The Open Boat, Chapter 5, and it goes a little something like this. "Pi," said the oiler and the correspondent, agitatedly, "don't talk about those things, blast you." "Well," said the cook, "I was just thinking about ham sandwiches and..." "A night on the sea in an open boat is a long night." As darkness settled, finally, the shine of the light, lifting from the sea in the south, changed to full gold. On the northern horizon, a new light appeared, a small bluish gleam on the edge of the waters. These two lights were the furniture of the world, otherwise there was nothing but waves. Two men huddled in the stern, and distances were so magnificent in the dinghy that the rower was enabled to keep his feet partly warmed by thrusting them under his companions. Their legs indeed extended far under the rowing seat until they touched the feet of the captain forward. Sometimes, despite the efforts of the tired oarsmen, a wave came piling into the boat, an icy wave of the night, and the chilling water soaked them anew. They would twist their bodies for a moment and groan, and sleep the dead sleep once more, while the water in the boat gurgled about them as the craft rocked. The plan of the oiler and the correspondent was for one to row until he lost the ability, and then aroused the other from his seawater couch in the bottom of the boat. The oiler plied the oars until his head drooped forward, and the overpowering sleep blinded him, and he rowed yet afterward. Then he touched a man in the bottom of the boat and called his name. "Will you spell me for a little while?" he said meekly. "Sure, Billy," said the correspondent, awakening and dragging himself to a sitting position. They exchanged places carefully, and the oiler, cuddling down in the sea water at the cook's side, seemed to go to sleep instantly. The particular violence of the sea had ceased. The waves came without snarling. The obligation of the man at the oars was to keep the boat headed so that the tilt of the rollers would not capsize her, and to preserve her from filling when the crests rushed past. The black waves were silent and hard to be seen in the darkness. Often one was almost upon the boat before the oarsman was aware. In a low voice the correspondent addressed the captain. He was not sure that the captain was awake, although this iron man seemed to always be awake. "Captain, shall I keep her making for that light north, sir?" The same steady voice answered him. "Yes, keep it about 2 points off the port bow." The cook had tied a life belt around himself in order to get even the warmth which this clumsy cork contrivance could donate, and he seemed almost stove-like when a rower, whose teeth invariably chattered wildly as soon as he ceased his labour, dropped down to sleep. The correspondent, as he rowed, looked down at the two men sleeping underfoot. The cook's arm was around the oiler's shoulders, and with their fragmentary clothing and haggard faces, they were the babes of the sea, a grotesque rendering of the old babes in the wood. Later he would have grown stupid at his work, for there was a growling of water, and a crest came with a roar and a swash into the boat, and it was a wonder that it did not set the cook afloat in his life belt. The cook continued to sleep, but the oiler sat up, blinking his eyes and shaking with the new cold. "Oh, I'm awful sorry, Billy," said the correspondent contritely. "That's all right, old boy," said the oiler, and lay down again and was asleep. Presently it seemed that even the captain dozed, and the correspondent thought that he was the one man afloat on all the oceans. The wind had a voice as it came over the waves, and it was sadder than the end. There was a long, loud swishing astern of the boat, and a gleaming trail of phosphorescence, like blue flame, was furrowed on the black waters. It might have been made by a monstrous knife. Then there came a stillness, while the correspondent breathed with the open mouth and looked at the sea. Suddenly there was another swish and another long flash of bluish light, and this time it was alongside the boat, and might almost have been reached with an oar. The correspondent saw an enormous fin speed like a shadow through the water, hurling the crystalline spray and leaving the long glowing trail. The correspondent looked over his shoulder at the captain. His face was hidden, and he seemed to be asleep. He looked at the babes of the sea. They certainly were asleep. So, being bereft of sympathy, he leaned a little way to one side and swore softly into the sea. But the thing did not then leave the vicinity of the boat. Ahead or astern, on one side or the other, at the intervals long or short, fled the long sparkling streak, and there was to be heard the whirroo of the dark fin. The speed and power of the thing was greatly to be admired. It cut the water like a gigantic and keen projectile. The presence of this biting thing did not affect the man with the same horror that it would if he had been a picnicker. He simply looked at the sea dully and swore in an undertone. Nevertheless, it is true that he did not wish to be alone. He wished one of his companions to awaken by chance and keep him company with it. But the captain hung motionless over the water jar, and the oiler and the cook in the bottom of the boat were plunged in slumber. All right, there we go. That's chapter 5 down. Jump over to the subreddit, reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist, to have your say about this chapter. That's 5 chapters down, 2 to go, in Stephen Crane's The Open Boat. Just a short story, but a lot has happened in this short story. All right, before we sign off, just a reminder, the Patreon page for this podcast, help me become a full-time podcaster. That's the goal. make this a part of my living. I've got all these different ideas for podcasts and stuff, but this is at the moment my only podcast that I've got up and running, and well, I love it. I love doing it. So my dream is to build up a bit of a following on Patreon so that I can put more time every day into making podcasts. At the moment, the podcast is made possible by the Patreon subscribers. That's kind of covering the hosting fees and the costs involved with running this thing. So a huge thanks to those supporters. If you would like to support the podcast with as little as $1 per month, head to patreon.com/thehemingwaylist, or you can buy the paperbacks at thehemingwaylist.com. That's a nice little keepsake of this whole project. Keep them on your bookshelf at home. All right. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.